I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is biblical scholar and translator Robert Alter. And now, join Rabbi Batshear Torchio on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Robert Alter.
Robert Alter has written widely and continuously, to mention a few works, on the European novel from the 18th century to the present, on contemporary American fiction, and on modern Hebrew literature. His dozens of published books, translated into 10 different languages, include two prize-winning volumes on biblical narrative and poetry, and award-winning translations of Genesis and of the five books of Moses. And now, the much-anticipated translation of the Hebrew Bible with a commentary in a three-volume set is completed. Though most full translations of the Bible are done by a team of translators, Robert Alter is the first person to complete a major English translation of the entire Hebrew Bible on his own. Bob's entire volume of work is stunning, as is his influence on our engagement with and understanding of the Bible as literature. Without apology or a theological explanation or extraction from the thornier material we find within, but with intimate deciphering of every word of the Hebrew Bible, Bob has gifted us a unique doorway that leads to a different landscape. New York Times writer Judith Shulevitz describes Bob's revolutionary read of the Bible in this way: with erudition and rigor and the keenest receptivity to its darker undertones, Alter's choice to be literal stems from the rare resolve not to look away from the text, even when it dismays us or ought to. Indeed, these are the anthologies, dark and radiant, political and poetic, mundane and mysterious. It is no wonder that UC Berkeley professor and colleague of Robert Alter's, Ron Hendel, has described his friend fittingly as a towering intellect of tremendous achievements. Robert Alter deserves all the glory that his translations have garnered. Friends, Professor Robert Alter.
Thank you very much, Batshear, for your very generous remarks. I only have to resist being called venerable, because I should have a flowing white beard, and since I don't, I guess I'll dodge that epithet. Now, let me say a few words first about why I should do this crazy thing. That is, you figure that there have been so many translations of the Bible. There's the King James Version. I'm talking about English translations, of course. The King James Version, which has been for many centuries almost canonical for English speakers. And then various committees. Of course, the King James is done by 40-some-odd people working in concert. Various committees, Jewish, Protestant, and Catholic, have produced in the second half of the 20th century new translations of the Bible, persuaded that the King James people got it all wrong. Now, I don't want to lecture on the King James Version, but I'll just say this. It is a grand achievement, what it does with biblical style does, in some ways, set a precedent. There are many lapses in it, strangely enough, more in the poetry than in the narrative prose. And there are many errors, quite a few minor errors and some really egregious errors. Finally, there is a certain Christian bias to the King James Version, which is understandable. They were all devout, learned Protestant clergymen. Now, the modern committees who have produced translations have taken things steeply downhill. And I will maybe allude to a few of the things they've done as I get into my specific examples on which I would like to build this presentation. But let me say a couple of things. First of all, they have kind of astoundingly a tin ear for English, which the King James translators didn't have. I think this may have something to do with the specialization of knowledge. That is, the translators back in the beginning of the 17th century were immersed in the literary culture of their age. And the leading figure among them, the Bishop of London, Lancelot Andrews, was a fine prose stylist, as we know from his published sermons. I don't think these translators today have read contemporary English poetry, good English prose, and it shows badly in their translations, which not only mix different levels of style and stick in contemporary-sounding phrases that are all wrong for the Bible, they even get English idioms wrong. Then, in the interest of trying to make the Bible, I put this in quotes, accessible, they more or less make it sound as though it were yesterday's newspaper, which seems to me all off for a set of texts composed between 2,500 to 3,000 years ago. Don't see what the articulation of literary form is in the Bible, and so their translations repeatedly do violence to that literary form, which I think is so crucial for making the Bible an effective vehicle, not just for literature to entertain, but for the monotheistic vision that they embody. And despite the fact, I used to be over-impressed by the academic credentials of these modern translators. And of course, I have in mind one that many in this room are familiar with, the Jewish Publication Society translation. I actually was personally acquainted with three or four of the people on those committees. And I thought, well, they really know what they're doing. They have PhDs in Bible from Johns Hopkins and Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania and so forth. But in fact, they often don't know what they're doing. They make all kinds of mistakes in constructing Hebrew words. Now, what I like to do is I'll take a few categories, word, sound, play, rhythm, and so forth. So let me begin with words, which is a common sensible thing that we all think about, even if we haven't thought that much about the nature of translation. We figure, well, a translator ought to convey a true and accurate sense of the meanings of the words in the original. But this often does not happen, as I will try to explain. So let me offer, as an analogy, a hypothetical translation of a modern French novel. Now, in my hypothetical French novel, there's a heroine who has green eyes, des yeux verts. You open the translation, and it turns out she has blue eyes. Now, why does she have blue eyes? Well, it's possible that the translator has a shaky sense of French. And you know, Sweeney, it's a color word, but maybe it's a different kind of blue, so I'll just call it blue. Even more likely is the translator says, well, with the complexion that's attributed to her by the novelist, it would be very improbable for her to have green eyes. So let's fix this up a little bit and make it blue. Now, that might be a trivial alteration, or again, it might be that this woman's beauty in the novel is focused on the fact that she has improbable green eyes. And maybe in this novel, there's a network of other greens, that she lives in a house with green shutters. Her lover drives a green sports car. Her annoying boss keeps talking about giving this project the green light. So if you transpose green to blue, you're wrecking something important in the novel. And this kind of thing happens again and again in Bible translation. So let's now begin to look at some examples. Okay, and I'll sort of fill in the context of each of the paragraphs, because I know some of you may know the Bible backwards and forwards. A few others might have hazy recollection. So in the Samson story, Samson marries a Philistine woman. And at the wedding celebration, where there are 30 Philistine guests, male guests, he proposes a wager. He pronounces a riddle to them, and he says, "If you can solve the riddle, I will give each of you 30 chalifot of garments." And chalifot clearly means changes. So 30 changes of garments. But then when his wife wheedles the secret of the riddle out of him, and the wedding guests know what it is, he's outraged, and he thinks that they've been playing fast and loose with his wife. So he storms down to the Philistine city of Gaza, and he kills 30 men, and he struck down from among them 30 men and took their chalitzot. Now you see, it's a word that looks like chalifot, but it had the middle consonant is different. All the translations I've looked at render it as changes of garment. But it doesn't mean that. How do we know it doesn't mean? Well, first, it's not the same word. Secondly, this word as a noun of something you wear occurs only one other time in the Bible. In the book of Samuel, there's a civil war going on between the house of Saul and the house of David. And Saul's canny, battle-hardened commander is fleeing from one of David's lieutenants, a man named Asael, who is a very fast runner. And he says to him, because he doesn't want to kill him, he doesn't want to make bad blood between him and Asael's brothers. So he says, "Swerve you to your right or your left, and seize for yourself one of the lads and take you his chalitza." So what is chalitza here? If you look at all the modern translations, they all say his garment, his tunic, his belt, I don't know what else, his underwear. Because they figure, well, in the Samson story, it clearly means a change of garments. But what does a warrior take from a slain foe in the battlefield? All of us who have read the Iliad, as the King James translators did, and as the Septuagint before them did, know that what you take from them is their garment, is their armor. And then it dawned on me that this word, chalitza, is cognate with another biblical word, chalutz, which means military vanguard. So the chalitzot were the special armor that the fighters in the vanguard were wearing. And this then throws a whole new light on the Samson story, because it's equivalent to my green eyes example. That is, the bet was for a change of garments. The infuriated Samson goes down to Gaza and says, I'm going to stick it to these Philistines. I'm going to kill not 30 ordinary Philistines, but 30 Philistine warriors. And I'm going to bring back to the wedding guests something far more valuable than 30 changes of garments, 30 sets of armor. So you see how one word misconceived can flip a story, or at least diminish a story. And this happens repeatedly. Now, let me go to another example. It's a puzzling word. Now, here, I should say this. It's not that simple to know what all the words in the Bible mean. And some of them, we're never going to know what they mean. They occur once. You can guess from context, but it's only guesswork. However, one of my gripes with the learned committees of the 20th century is that they don't look at the literary context. As, for example, the battlefield scene with Joab and Asael, which often give you a clue to what the word means. So here at the end of the book of Samuel, there's a victory psalm. These are set out as lines of poetry. A victory psalm attributed to David. And there's a word that no one knows what to make of. You gave me your shield, you as God. You gave me your shield of rescue. Your anot made me many. Now, what is that? Anot means to answer. So you're answering? So some translators say you're answering power. I think the Jewish Publication Society says your providence, which has no warrant whatever. It's all guesswork. And the term was not fully understood in the ancient period. How do I know that? The same psalm is transcribed as Psalm 18 in the book of Psalms. And there, the scribe decided to switch anot to anava, which means something like humility. Your humility made me many, which also doesn't make any sense. So I thought about this a bit, and I said, what's the context, the poetic context in which anot occurs? It's a list of weapons, a powerful spear, a bow of bronze, and so forth, that God gives the victorious warrior. So what could Anot be doing in this list? Well, in the golden calf story in Exodus, it also appears. And when Moses comes down from the mountain, and the Israelites are reveling around around the idol of the golden calf, he says, not the sound of anot in triumph, and not the sound of anot in defeat, a sound of anot I hear. Okay, the biblical word anot means two things. It means to answer. That's its maybe more common meaning. But it also means to speak out. Like in the book of Job, very often when Job is not answering anybody, it says, Vaya'an Iyov Vayomar, and Job spoke out and said. So I think that a note in triumph is a clue to the a note in the David victory psalm. I think it means battle cry. That is, in the list of weapons, there is the battle cry, made me many, even though my troops were few. So it would be a battle cry like the sword of the Lord and of David. And it scared the hell out of the enemy and was part of psychological warfare, let's say.
You're listening to biblical scholar Robert Alter, whose latest work is The Hebrew Bible, a translation with commentary, the first single-author literary translation of the complete Hebrew Bible, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Okay, now one last example of a word, and then we'll go on to a different category. The story of Hagar. You remember, Hagar is banished into the wilderness with her son Ishmael at Sarah's instance. Abraham doesn't quite want to do it, but God says if she tells you to do it, you better do it. So, she has a limited supply of water, and they're probably somewhere in the southern Negev near the Egyptian border, and the water runs out. And when the water in the skin was gone, she, and the Hebrew verb is tashlech, vatashlichenu, and she, vatashlech, that's a, and she tashlech the child under one of the bushes and went off and sat down at a distance, for she thought, let me not see when the child dies. Now, every translation I look at fudges this. How do they translate it? They say, she put him under one of the bushes, she laid him down under one of the bushes, she set him under one of the bushes, or the King James Version is closer, but still off the mark, says she thrust him under one of the bushes. But this Hebrew word, verb, lashlich, has one and only meaning whenever it occurs in the Bible. It means to fling. It's the same word that's used at the beginning of Exodus when Pharaoh says, every male child you shall fling into the Nile. So what's going on? I think that the writer is making a bold stroke, which the translators don't have the guts to follow. That is, the writer is saying, this desperate woman who has an only child is convinced that in a matter of minutes, her only son is going to die, and she can't face it. So in a kind of paroxysm of maternal grief, she flings him down and then runs off so she won't see when he dies. The translators couldn't quite digest this, so they softened it with these various terms that I've just sketched. So that would be rather analogous to my example with the green eyes. And the translator said, well, the eyes couldn't be green, so let me fix that. And the fixing, of course, destroys something important. Okay. By the way, it was not on purpose, but many of my examples have to do with murder, rape, imminent death, and so forth. Stuff that they don't focus on in Sunday school. This is because of the nature of the Hebrew Bible. It's a profoundly realistic set of stories, and these writers knew that the world was a rough place, that bad things happen to people, people do terrible things to other people, and it happens to be reflected in a lot of the stories. So, in 2 Samuel 13, one of David's sons, remember he has children from different wives in his harem. So one of David's sons, Amnon, lusts after his beautiful half-sister, Tamar. And a good buddy of his proposes a strategy. He says, pretend you're ill and say that Tamar has to come into your bedchamber and prepare this special food for you. So Amnon sends, by the way, he does end up raping her, and all kinds of disasters follow this act. Let Tamar, my sister, pray, come, and tavreni with food, and prepare the birya before my eyes. Now, the capitalized words are cognate with each other. One is a verb, tavreni, and the other is a noun, birya. All the translations, I think without exception, translate birya as food. But I thought that can't be right, because there are two good standard words for food in the Bible. One is ochel, which comes from the verb that means to eat, and the other is lechem, bread, which is stands for all other food. And this word birya and the verb that goes with it are rather rare in the Bible, but they occur maybe half a dozen times in the story of the rape of Tamar by her half-brother. So I checked out in the Hebrew concordance all the occurrences, and there are not that many, of birya and the verb that's attached to it. And in every instance, it's food you give somebody who has been failing or fasting or is ill in some way. It's not an accident that in rabbinic Hebrew, the feast, the meal that you give to someone, a mourner, when he returns from the cemetery is called su'udat havra'ah, the same verbal root. So, this is not any kind of food. It's food that sustains you when you're failing. So I couldn't translate it as chicken soup because they hadn't domesticated the chicken yet. So instead, I settled on, it's not perfect, but on nourishment, which gives you something of the sense of food given to somebody who needs sustaining. So this is a matter of not an out-and-out error, as in the case of chalitza, and not a fudging, as in the case of vatashlech, but of missing a nuance. And of course, nuances are very important in literary texts. Now, finally, my last example is nefesh. Nefesh is an impossible word in biblical Hebrew. It is almost always translated in the King James Version and in many modern versions in a lot of instances as soul. The problem with that is that there's no biblical concept of soul. There's no notion of a soul-body split. So nefesh is a life breath, and by extension, the life. And by extension, in another direction, the throat or the neck. Like where the King James Version, this is corrected by other moderns, waters have come up even into my soul, which is crazy. It's I'm drowning. Waters have come up to my neck. And here, these are two lines from Psalms. God, my God, for you I search. My nefesh thirsts for you. My flesh yearns for you in a land waste and parched with no water. Now, my soul thirsts for you. It has a kind of beauty, but I think it's wrong. First of all, because there's no biblical conception of soul. But secondly, if you look at the context, it's parallel with flesh, and it's hooked up with thirst. So I think my throat thirsts for you. It's a very physical thing. And the Hebrew Bible is very often highly physical. Okay, let us go on to dialogue. Dialogue is the central vehicle of biblical storytelling. When something important is going to happen, it's transposed into dialogue. So let's look at this famous moment in Genesis of the selling of the birthright. Right. And Jacob prepared a stew, and Esau came from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, let me gulp down some of this red stuff, for I am famished. Now, other translators have said this red stuff and also gulp down, because it's not the ordinary biblical word for swallowing or eating, but it's a crude word. But nobody has really repeated the wonderful red. In the Hebrew, all he says is red, no stuff, which conveys so vividly the inarticulateness of this man of appetite. But then let's go on to Jacob's word, which will anticipate something I want to say at the end about word order. And Jacob said, sell now your birthright to me. Now look at the word order. These are Jacob's first words. And one of my rules of thumb is that the first words that a character speaks are often defining of the character. So first there's the imperative, sell. Then now, not tomorrow, not next week, but right now. And then he has withhold the object of sale cunningly, your birthright. And then at the end of the chain in the sentence, to me. So everything is calculated. As Jacob is a calculating man, a shrewd bargainer, he even bargains with God. And if you look at the various translations of the moderns, and I think the King James too, they mess with this word order. And you see how crucial the word or order is. Now, here's a particular fun one. And God came to Abimelech in a night dream. Abraham has come to the kingdom of Gerar. Abimelech is the king. And he's passed off Sarah as his wife. And Abimelech has taken Sarah into his harem. And God came to Abimelech in a night dream and said to him, you are a dead man because of the woman you took, as she is another's wife. Okay, there's something very abrupt and startling about God, you are a dead man, in the Hebrew, two words, hincha met. But Abimelech had not come near her, obviously sexually, and he said, my Lord, will you slay a nation even if innocent? Now, this sounds weird. It definitely sounds weird in my translation, but it sounds weird in the Hebrew. Hagoy gam tzati taharog. And here I think that, well, one of my guiding principles in translating dialogue from the Bible is that you have to look for deformations of language which are significant. So, like the red in our previous example. So, here, I think, now, the nation is presumably Abimelech, who is as king, is representative of the nation. But it's such a strange wording. This story comes immediately after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And it's almost as if not Avimelech, then the author behind him is hinting, are you up to your old tricks again, killing entire nations, even if there are innocent people of them? Did she not say to me, she is my sister, and she too said, he is my brother. Now, the she too is in the Hebrew. It's he, gam hi amra. It's a kind of splutter of indignation, and everyone smooths it, all my predecessors, I say, smooths it out. They say, well, you know, people in the Bible should speak correctly, but that's not the point, is it? And then this continues, and Abimelech called to Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us, and how have I offended you that you should bring upon me and my kingdom so great offense? Things that should not be done you have done to me. Then Abraham does not answer, which you're supposed to do in biblical dialogue, which is usually a clue that the person being spoken to has a problem in response. He's embarrassed, amazed, perplexed, whatever. So Abimelech repeats himself, "What did you imagine when you did this thing?" And Abraham said, "For I thought there's surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife." And in point of fact, and here he uses this kind of odd phrase, omna, which I think is a legalistic term. He's kind of splitting hairs, setting up a smokescreen. And in point of fact, she's my sister, my father's daughter, not my mother's daughter, and she became my wife. And it happened when the gods made me a wanderer from my father's house, that I told her, I'm sorry, there's a word missing, "This is the kindness you can do for me. In every place to which we come, save me, he is my brother." Now, as far as I know, I'm the first translator of the Bible to say, "The gods made me a wanderer." So you go, well, how, Abraham, he's the first monotheist. What's he doing talking about the gods? Why am I sure that I'm right? Many of you probably know that there is a standard word for God in the Bible, Elohim. And Elohim has a masculine plural ending, but it's almost always treated grammatically as a singular. But there are a couple of places where it's treated as a plural, and this happens to be one of them. And when it's treated as a plural, it means the gods. So what's happening is a vivid piece of dialogue in which Abraham is speaking to a polytheist. So he says, you know, when the gods made me a wanderer, which could almost have the sense of the fate, my destiny made me a wanderer. And you see, you spoil it when you make him an impeccable monotheist and he has to say God. Now, okay, one last example of a deformation, deliberate deformation of language in dialogue. The rebel son Absalom is, his forces are defeated by David's forces, and he's killed by David's general, actually. David had said, "Deal gently with the lad Absalom," but they kill him. And a man named Ahimaaz runs ahead to bring word of the victory to David. And he arrives panting at David's temporary station in Transjordan. And he says, "Blessed is the Lord your God who has delivered over the men who raised their hand against my lord the king." And the king said, "Is it well with the lad, Absalom?" Which I couldn't do what the Hebrew does, which is, "Hashalom lana'ar av shalom." And Ahimaaz said, "I saw a great crowd to send the king's servant Joab and your servant I know not what." And the king said, "Turn aside, stand by." Now, every single translation I've looked at turns Ahimaaz's second speech into coherent English. But it's incoherent, deliberately so, in the Hebrew. That is, he's been challenged by David. He doesn't want to bring the bad word to the king that his son has been killed. So he starts babbling, and the babbling is the incoherent language. And you can, a clue to the fact that he's babbling is the king's impatience. And the king said, "Turn aside, stand by." And I'm not going to get anything out of this guy.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is biblical scholar Robert Alter, whose latest work is The Hebrew Bible, a translation with commentary, the first single-author literary translation of the complete Hebrew Bible. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Let's go on to sound and wordplay. Psalm 30, what prophet in my blood, the speaker says, who has nearly died, ma betza bidami is the Hebrew, in my going down deathward. To anticipate what I'm going to say in a couple of minutes about rhythm, you might hear that try to replicate the Hebrew rhythm in this line of poetry. That is, ma betza bidami, what prophet in my blood. The King James almost gets it, but they say, what prophet is there in my blood, which wrecks the rhythm. The modern translators all shrink from saying blood, and they say death, as though a modern reader, they seem to assume, this is a crazy assumption, that modern readers cannot understand a metaphor. Okay, but then the interesting challenge, you've turned my misspade to a machol for me. That is, hafachta misbedi lemachol li. Now, when I looked at that and when I listened to it, I realized the fact that both the word for mourning or a song, a chant of mourning, misbed, and the word for dance, machol, begin with the same consonant, with an M. That's very important for the poet, because God has the ability to take something and flip it. A word that begins to sound like another word turns out to be its opposite. And then I got lucky, which often you do not get as a translator. I said, there's a good word for a chant of mourning in English that begins with a D. You have turned my dirge to a dance for me. Okay, now Isaiah. Isaiah was a master of taking two words that sounded like each other, but were opposite in meaning. And he does this to convey the 180-degree perversion of values in his society. So you see that the sound play or the word play is very important. So in the first chapter of Isaiah, you have Saraich. The first word means leaders or nobles or whatever. Sorerim, which would be literally wayward. So I rendered that as your nobles are knaves. But here is a bigger challenge and kind of fun to play with. He here is God. He hoped for mishpat. Mishpat means justice. And look, mispach. Now, mispach is a blight. He hoped for tzedakah, which is righteousness. And look, tzaka, a scream. Now, I couldn't get this without allowing myself a slight liberty, but I thought I could because the sound play is so significant. So I said, he hoped for justice and look jaundice, for righteousness and look wretchedness. Now, there might be other ways to solve this, but the thing is that translators don't even try to solve it. Okay. Let me move on quickly to rhythm. And God made, this is from Genesis 1, you're probably all familiar with it, and God made the two great lights, the great light for dominion of day and the small light for dominion of night and the stars. Now, when I started out, I didn't know entirely what I was doing. And when I put this down in my draft, I said, why am I doing dominion? Well, I did it all the translations, to rule over, to govern. The worst of all is the JPS, which says to dominate. Now, Soviet Russia dominates the smaller countries of Eastern Europe in the post-war era, but the heavenly luminaries don't dominate day and night. So that's part of the tin ear thing I was talking about. But also, to dominate wrecks the cadence. And The priestly writer's sense of stately cadence is so important to convey his vision of harmonious creation. So the great light for dominion of day and the small light for dominion of night more or less replicates the Hebrew cadence of Et ha-maor ha-gadol le-memshelet ha-yom v'et ha-maor ha-katon le-memshelet ha-layla v'et ha-kochavi. So I think that rhythm is very important for our experience of the text. I mean, if you imagine a crazy editor taking Moby Dick and with a draft and wrecking all the beautiful iambic cadences that make you think of Milton and Shakespeare and the King James Bible, you can see what happens to these translations of the Bible. Now, here's a more subtle one. Sometimes you do something as a translator that no one's going to notice, but you feel satisfaction. And maybe it gets to the reader subliminally. So after David has had adultery with Bathsheba and then contrived to have her husband killed, Nathan the prophet comes to him and he begins his spiel with a parable. Two men there were in a single town. One was rich and the other poor. The rich man had sheep and cattle in great abundance, and the poor man had nothing save one little ewe that he had bought. And he nurtured her and raised her with him together with his sons. From his crust she would eat, and from his cup she would drink, and in his lap she would lie, and she was to him like a daughter. Now, you might have heard in my reading out loud a kind of sing-song rhythm. And the sing-song goes along with the fact that it's unlike the surrounding narrative, that it's a parable. It's not about the real world. For example, crust, cup, drink is in the Hebrew a string of monosyllables, pot, kos, chek, like that. And I think that the rhythm is important. It's a kind of signal to the ancient audience that David doesn't get it. He doesn't realize this is a parable. And he, in indignation, he says, "This man shall be, sentenced to such and such." And then Nathan says, "You are the man." So rhythm is not just decorative, but it's important for meaning. Now, word order. When Joseph's brothers come back to the land of Canaan after their first visit to Egypt, they tell their father, old Jacob, that the man who rules over all Egypt, with Joseph, will not see them again unless they bring down their brother Benjamin. And meanwhile, he's taken Simeon as a hostage. So Jacob responds in the following way: "Me you have bereaved. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and Benjamin you would take. It is I who bear it all." Now, obviously, I'm sure everyone in the room has noticed that this is strange word order in the translation. "Me you have bereaved." The way you say it in English, "You have bereaved me." But the Hebrew is also strange. That is, the normal way to say "you have bereaved me" in biblical Hebrew is to take the verb that means bereave and to put a suffix at the end of it that means "me." It would be like this: "shikaltuni." The shikaltu is "you bereaved," and the "ni" at the end is "me." Okay, but the writer doesn't do that. Instead, he breaks out the "me" unusually, "oti," "oti shikaltem," and he puts the "me" at the very beginning of the sentence. Why is this important? I think that it's important because Jacob, after what he supposes is his beloved son Joseph's death, has become a kind of prima donna of paternal grief. He's always putting himself at the center of it and his terrible suffering. You know, we all know mothers like that, but here it's a father. So he has to start with me, Oti, me you have bereaved. Okay, this is a syntactical inversion, which we don't normally use today. But if we've read a little poetry, even going back as recently as the 19th century, you see that syntactical inversion is all over the place, like Keats's famous sonnet and on first looking into Chapman's home, much have I traveled in the realms of gold. Now, the normal, I've traveled much in the realms of gold, but for him it's important to invert. So now here's an inversion in, and again, translators, even to a large extent the King James translators, but definitely all the moderns, just avoid inversion of syntax, of word order, like the plague, even when it's very important. So, this is from the first chapter of Isaiah. Sons I have nurtured and raised, but they rebelled against me. Now, this is what scholars call fronting, where you put a word at the front of the sentence that normally would belong somewhere else. And I think it's important that as God is highlighting the sons, these people were sons for me, but they rebelled against me. Okay, my final category, which I'll try to polish off in 4 or 5 minutes, is word order, which relates to, of course, what we've just looked at. In the third chapter of Judges, an enterprising Israelite rebel named Ehud assassinates the Moabite king Eglon. The Israelites had been subjugated by the Moabites. And he stabs him with a short sword, which he has hidden under his tunic, and then he flees through some mysterious back exit. No one has quite figured out what it is. And meanwhile, the door is locked, and they're waiting for his courtiers are waiting for their master to come out, and he doesn't come out. They smell a stench, which is because the anal sphincter has been released when he was stabbed. And they think, well, you know, he's taken care of his bodily functions. But he still doesn't come out. So, and they took the key and opened the doors, and look, their master was fallen to the ground dead. Now, I just want to focus on the word order. What I've translated as look, hine, is very often used to shift to the character's point of view, the visual point of view. So here is a collective point of view of the king's courtiers. So, and look, their master, they identify whom they see, was fallen to the ground dead. At the end of the chain, they realize that he's finished. Again, every translation that I've looked at says something, their master was dead, fallen on the ground, or something like that, which you see how that spoils the climactic effect. Now, my very last example is this. In the Akedah story, the story of the binding of Isaac, God speaks out to Abraham at the beginning and says, take, pray, your son, your only one, whom you love, Isaac. Now, again, what you'll find in the various 20th century translations is something like, take your favorite beloved son, or take Isaac, your favorite son whom you love. But the sequence is really remarkable and very important. The Midrash in late antiquity understood this. It parsed it this way. It invented an imaginary dialogue between God and Abraham, which Rashi picks up. It says, take your son. Abraham says, I have two sons. Your only one, this one is an only one to his mother, and this one is an only one to your mother, whom you love. And the Midrash says, is there any partition in love in a person? Isaac. So the thing that he's trying to get away from is sprung on him at the very end of this little piece of dialogue. And if you don't follow the word order of the Hebrew, you miss the whole thing. I think that that should be enough. I've held forth quite long. So let me say in a sentence or two of summary that in order to see fully what's going on in the Bible, that is, to see the nature of the characters, the nature of their interaction in dialogue, the way themes are deployed, you absolutely have to pay attention to the literary formulation of these texts, which is often quite wonderful, as I hope you have glimpsed in these few examples I've shared with you. And to the best of my ability, that's what I've tried to do in my translation. And the sorry story is that other translators have not seen that the literary articulation is crucial, and so they haven't even tried to do this. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was biblical scholar Robert Alter, whose latest work is The Hebrew Bible, a translation with commentary, the first single-author literary translation of the complete Hebrew Bible. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, and Alex Espalay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamantuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.